I raised a number of questions from some of you as we considered this sixth vision. And so let me go back through Zechariah chapter 5 quickly and see if we can just cook it for you. You recall that in Zechariah 5 verse 1, "Then I turned and lifted up mine eyes." So we have a turning back from the glorious vision of the lampstand back into the future to now look at some of the causal factors for Israel's dilemma that this then was to usher in. We have a contrast of twos. The number two, you know, represents opposites. It represents separation, and it also implies a sure or fixed thing. So we have a sure or fixed thing in the two olive trees and the two anointed sons of oil. And now we are going to look in a different direction, and we continue to have a series of twos as well. So in Zechariah 5 then, chapter 3 or verse 3, we have a flying scroll that was to go forth from that time. On both sides of it are written indictments, and one is referenced for everyone that stealeth. Hence, you have reference to thievery, the thievery of the Word of God. The other side is false swearings, or those who would sweareth or take God's name in vain, that being in the application of His Word. So this indicting scroll that goes forth is represented of the corruption of the Word of Yahweh going forth and having its termination at 70 AD. Now, in verse 4, "I will bring it forth, saith the Lord, and it shall enter into the house of the thief and into the house of him that sweareth falsely. And it shall remain in the midst of his house, and shall consume it with its timbers and its stones." Now, this language is right out of Leviticus 14:45, where you have reference to how leprosy was to be dealt with under the law of Moses. And the priest, in this case it was Jesus, the priest at that time would go into a leprous house, and he would look around and to see if it had spread or not, if there were more occupants of the house that were ill. Jesus went into the house in Israel in Matthew 23, and he examined it, and he found that that strata of scribes and Pharisees were leprous indeed. He called them whited sepulchers. He called them hypocrites. He exposed them. And in the teaching of Leviticus 14, that person's house would then be torn down and taken into an unclean place. And hence we have the prophetic fulfillment at the time of Christ when the Jerusalem temple was torn down in 70 AD. And after the parable at the end of Matthew 23, where he references the blood of righteous Abel, the countertype was they were the ones aligned with Cain, and hence Cain was taken into the land of Nod or exile, and therefore this unclean house was likewise figuratively taken into a land of uncleanness. And we know that by the completion of this chapter, the two storks bore this ephah and the woman, with the content being Babylonish commercialism, into the land of Shinar. Now, we said that in verse 5 and 6, the ephah was a Jewish measure of commerce, and it was, moreover, it was their resemblance, which we said was their eye. Their eye, their focus, their resemblance was totally on commercialism. Inside was a woman. This Babylonish woman came back from the captivity. She is found to be in a seated position. She was comfortable. She had set up a nest or a base at that time within Judaism. There was a lead cover on it. Lead is a soft metal. It's a toxic metal, and it was positioned for a meltdown. We're told in verse 7 that this woman inside is referenced as wickedness, or rendered lawlessness, or we might say this is the lawless one that we find in 2 Thessalonians 2, verse 8. The mystery of iniquity was already beginning to foment within that strata, and the Apostle Paul was quick to pick that up, wasn't he, in some of his writings. And so the whole thing was set up for a meltdown at some point in time. Then shall that wicked one be revealed, who Christ will destroy at the brightness of his coming. He exposed it at his first coming, did he not? Jesus figuratively in verse 8, he lifted the lid. He exposed it in Matthew 23, identifying the hypocrites within. He slammed the lid down, and the pending judgment is what followed at 70 AD. Now, the two women then who had stork-like wings were representative of the two apostate daughters of Israel, Israel and Judah. Israel, the ten tribes, had already been carried off, but their influence and remnant was still left. So they were now branded as unclean like storks. Storks are migratory birds, and they were then destined to fulfill the wandering Jew prophecy for the next 2,000 years. Israel had been rejected, the lid had been slammed shut, and now imminent judgment was about to happen. Now I'm reading from Matthew 23. And you'll notice here what happened. Jesus, this was his last appearance in the temple. This was his last harsh message in the temple before he was to be crucified. He lamented over Jerusalem in 37. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them who are sent unto thee, how often would I have gathered thy children together, even as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings, and you would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. That's an important phrase because that's a change of tense. It is no longer my Father's house, as you have referenced over in Matthew 21, verse 13. It is written, my house shall be called the house of prayer. The tense has changed. Jesus has abandoned the temple, and he has abandoned that generation of Jews. And if you want to draw a countertype to this, it's the same as the Shekinah glory leaving Ezekiel's temple and Ezekiel. Shekinah glory is the indwelling resident glory of Yahweh. It officially left the house. Jesus was the Shekinah glory of his time, and he was destined to leave. Now 39, before I say unto you, you shall not see me henceforth till you shall say, blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord. And that yet has to happen to Israel. Jews have yet to acknowledge the Christ factor, that he came the first time and what he accomplished. Now, the storks carry this ephah away back in Zechariah. They carried away to a new place for it to rest. So we have on the overhead a nesting stork. That's a picture out of medieval Europe, but you get the idea. Now, the Jewish commercialism, the base of a new religion, is not allowed to continue to reside in Israel, is it? It is blown by the east wind. After 70 AD, it is blown out of Israel. It has to find a new place to settle in. And so consequently, that new base is Rome. That's the power that was in power at that time. And it's referenced that there was to be a new house then. And he said unto me in verse 11, to build for it a house, which is another religious system in the land of Shinar, or the enemy's tooth, and it shall be established and set there upon its own base. Now one thing, And so this flying scroll was going to take its influence along with Jewish commercialism and all that that implies into another land to set up shop. And we consider the Judaizing and the churning within the first 200 years of the apostolic movement. Now, one thing I've edited out is that Rome already had the mystery religion of Babylon within it. This is a bit of linkage that's pretty cool. The Babylonish mystery religion and her hosts of maintaining priests were tolerated by the Medes and the Persians, and they were there in presence when Alexander the Great took over, before the invading army of Alexander the Great. They were allowed to pack up lock, stock, and barrel, and they took this whole Babylonish priesthood to Pergamon, And so when the Romans came and took Asia Minor, the king of Pergamon had no legal heir, and it was a bloodless coup rather than a fight. He gave and surrendered totally to the invading army of Rome, and he gave them lock, stock, and barrel, a Babylonish contingency and its entire priesthood. So there was that base there. Now, this then brings us down to the Jezebel factor that we have referenced in the early lampstand ecclesias. The Jezebel factor is just another visual way of saying you have a woman that comes out of historical Israel. She was a Phoenician princess. She married Ahab. She brought Babylonish ideas out of Phoenicia, which was right there in the vicinity of Pergamon. And we now say that in Revelation 12, we have a pregnancy and we have a deliverance. And so we have this system. Gestation is 280 days. You do your count from 33 AD when the apostolic church was officially established after Christ. And you do your math, and you come up at 313, and you have the man-child born in Revelation 12. And we know this then was the budding system of the Catholic Church that came online under the sanction of Constantine. Catholic just means universal church. The Roman universal church comes online at that time. Now we have to keep moving. We are now ready for the last vision. We are in Zechariah 6. This encompasses verses 1 to 9 here, basically. And I turned and lifted up my eyes and looked, and behold, there came four chariots out from between the two mountains. So we have another turning, and now we're looking back, and we're looking at this vision, and we're also going to see in our peripheral vision, our first vision, which is the four horsemen amongst the myrtle trees, because that's the end of it all. The battle's over. We have here referenced two mountains on the overhead, and this then corresponds to the two mountains of bronze. Bronze was Grecian. When you understand the breakup of Alexander the Great's kingdom under his four generals, and the Grecian were the most eastern aspect of that. They are basically a north and south, and so you have the chariots going out from between them. They're different colored. I could only find these, but these are fiery, and that's appropriate as well. They came out from between the two mountains. The mountains were mountains of bronze. That also means tried faith, flesh, smoking, burning. This is a burning, smoking scenario when you get into it. The first horse was red, the second was black, the third was white, and the fourth was dappled. And you can look at Revelation 6 if you want an understanding of these colors, because they all represent different scenarios of a battle campaign. You've got your bright red for immediate bloodshed. You've got your white for lingering plagues and disasters. You have dapple for other kinds of diseases and plagues. This is not Revelation 6. That applied to the Roman Empire between 96 and 324 AD, but the colors you can assume are the same. Now, in verse 5, these are the four spirits of the heavens which go forth from standing before the Lord of all the earth. This is the same as the two anointed ones, the two sons of oil under the lampstand vision. Before the Lord, the Adon, the ruler of all the earth. This you can reference to Revelation 4. Anytime you have this heavenly host, the living creatures going forth from before the throne of Yahweh to do His word, this is a similar picture. And you have two going into the north country, and one goes south, and one goes back and forth throughout the land. So, as we referenced earlier, the north country was the area of greatest concentrated hostility that will be bearing down on Israel, and it still is. Now, I want to take a look at Matthew 24 for a series of sequences here. And you'll see that this comes off of Matthew 23, where Jesus left the temple after His scathing rebuke. And then in 24, His disciples are naturally interested in, on a private basis, in 24:1, and Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and the disciples came to Him and said to Him, "Show me the buildings of the temple." And this is where Jesus gives the reference, "There shall not be left here one stone upon another." So they want to know about how's the end time going to play out. Now, let's take a look here then, and we'll see that the Mount Olivet prophecy does give us a sequence. And I'm down here at verse 29. "Immediately after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give its light, and the stars shall fall from heaven." We're talking about the Jewish sun and the Jewish moon. "The luminaries of that generation shall be darkened, and the stars shall fall from heaven." Read that, Jewish political heavens. "And the powers of the heaven shall be shaken." And now we're ready for verse 30. "And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man." That "and then" you can ascribe almost 1900 years to if you want to. We are in that "and then" parentheses. "And then shall the sign of the Son of Man in heaven," shall you see that. And then, that's another time chunk. We don't know how long that time chunk is from the return of Christ to "all the tribes of the earth mourning, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven," read saints, "with power and great glory." So, this is a little sequence. And if we were to say then that, as some have grappled with, that this would suggest that Jesus reveals Himself to the world with much flair, and that after that, verse 31 is the resurrection, then much is left out. This leaves out many prophecies that we have of the gathering of Christ in the southern regions in Sinai and the march of the rainbowed arrow, angel. So verse 29 is giving closure to the events of 70 AD. Verse 30 is telling us that the new heaven in verse 30, then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. You might read political heavens. And then covers a gap of about 2,000 years. And then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man. Or we could read, in the regenerated Jewish political heavens, will be seen at some point in time the realization that Jesus has returned, which we have witnessed, and we have witnessed a sign already in the political heavens, have we not? We've witnessed the work of Herzl at the end of the 1800s. We've witnessed the work of the Rothschilds. We've witnessed the work of the Zionist Congress. We've witnessed Israel coming online in 1948. So there have been plenty of signs in the geopolitical heavens because we have an entity of Israel in our face right now. And we are at the end of this. And then I said, we have this other and then. And this then is where we are waiting. We are waiting for this second and then. Now it's the same situation as in Revelation 16, where we have the work of the frog-like spirits that draw them together for the battle of Armageddon. We are in that drawing together stage right now. We are at the very end of that sixth vial waiting for Armageddon, a heap of sheaves drawn Zionward, the Valley of Jehoshaphat, for Yahweh's judgment. Now let me just tick off a little list of sequences. I'm sure not infallible. This is only what I have gleaned. I'm going to use the word simultaneous because this means events are going on at the same time. We can't say it's this or that. So, one, we have some kind of local forceful resolution of the pressing Arab problem to establish a pseudo-peace in Israel. That may break out in the next month as we watch Israel withdraw from Gaza. Two, this is leading to the anger of the world against Israel. Three, the simultaneous resurrection and judgment of the household occurs without fanfare and flare to the world. Four, the work of Elijah within Israel to prepare a remnant who will be receptive, the one-third in preparation. Five, a simultaneous evil thought process is kindled within Gog, fanned by the work of the saints within Israel, regionally and no doubt nationally. Six, Armageddon or the actual assault of Gog south into Israel would occur. The clash with the army of God from the south, the earthquake of Zechariah 14, the humbling and saving of a Jewish remnant, and this then concludes in verse 30 of Matthew 24, which we've been considering. They shall see the Son of Man coming in clouds of heaven with power and great glory after the blowout in Jerusalem. The call and demand, number 8 of Revelation 14:7, will go out to the nations from Jerusalem. That's the famous, fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment is come. Needless to say, that will be spurned. The spreading battle into the regions of the beast, or Europe, represented by the charioteers of Zechariah 6, to engage the figurative 10 kings of the EU and to decimate the papal whore. So we'll talk about this in just a minute as the two chariots go forth in Zechariah 6. Two go into the north country. 10, simultaneous to this is the realization and the continued call to Jewry scattered abroad to come out of her my people. This is a figurative regathering of the lost 10 tribes that you be not partakers of her sins, and that you receive not of her plagues, as we have reference for us in Revelation 18:4. Now notice back in Matthew 24, verse 30, that it is referenced all the tribes. All the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming. This is the realization of worldwide Jewry, at least we might say a significant portion, that their Messiah has delivered Israel. And they shall understand that Jesus has come to the political heavens with his army of saints and now his Jewish mortal contingency. So in Matthew then 31, the context follows verse 30. And he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the earth to the other. I realize this has been referenced also as the resurrection. I would submit that the elect are now the Jewish mortal remnant, the elect of God, because the resurrection's already passed and taken place, and they are now called to return, to come out of her, my people. And this is a quote right out of Zechariah 2, verse 4 to 8. And so, you might recall we referenced this. And he said unto him, Run, speak to this young man, saying, Jerusalem shall be inhabited like towns without walls for the multitude of men and cattle. For I saith the Lord, will be unto it a wall of fire round about it, and be the glory in the midst of it. Ho, ho, come forth and flee from the land of the north, saith the Lord, for I have spread you abroad as the four winds of the heavens, saith the Lord. So then I would suggest that the sound of the great trumpet is not the trumpet of resurrection, but this is like a jubilee trumpet. This is like a trumpet that called Israel Zionward for the feast days. And this then is a figurative type of calling dispersed Jewry home. Then we finish that with a parable of the fig tree, which we're all familiar with. And we have all done our math on that, and we have said that the parable of the fig tree was 1948, when Israel came online, put forth leaves, and now we've been waiting, and the time has come and gone. What if, and hindsight's great, isn't it? What if we said that the putting forth of leaves was officially at 1967, when all of Jerusalem was in the hands now after the Six-Day War of Israel. Now you add your 40 years to 67, and you come up with 2007. Just a thought. Christadelphians like numbers. Now, continuing in Zechariah 6, we have this picture then before us, and we have the charioteers of Yahweh, four of them. On the overhead, I have added a rainbow because you can tag this alongside of the March of the Rainbowed Angel in Revelation 10. And we all, the colors of the rainbow represent an entirely lovely picture. You have, that's more reddish, you have your conflict and security, and as the colors unfold, you come down to the royal garb of Christ as king, and then you have royal majesty and total secure rulership. You have half of a rainbow, don't you, when you look at it? This comes, of course, out of the covenant given to Noah, but just as we look at a rainbow as mortals and we only see half of it, we can align ourselves with the Jews in Israel under the Mosaic order, who were privileged to provide oil for the lampstand in the holy place, but they could only witness that glow as it would shine through the sides of that tabernacle tent. They never got to behold the pure glory of it. Just as we look at half the rainbow, we can only visualize what fulfillment will be like. And in the kingdom age, that fulfillment will be marvelous indeed. The rainbow is also a reminder that eight souls were saved in the ark. And so this whole glorious picture results in total resolution at the eighth day, when all darkness will be crowded out. Now, we want to get back to this in trying to wrap it up in 15 minutes. We have the king of the north and the king of the south represented in these two brazen mountains of brass. The king of the north is, and regard these two bronze mountains as subsets of the great looming mountain that Zerubbabel saw that he would stand, that would be looming before him, which meant upon his resurrection, this system will be there intact menacingly. The two subsets are these two mountains of bronze then. We have the pivotal center is the nation of Israel. We have the great looming Daniel's image referenced in Ezekiel 38, which is going to have to stand up at some point in time. We are in the clay and iron fleck toe stages. This image is top heavy. It's been there brewing historically for 6,000 years. It won't be standing very long because the stone power will be able to easily begin to bring it down. Nation of Israel is where these four chariots go forth out of, two into the north country to engage this confederacy. And what do we have with this other southern bronze mountain? It's called the King of the South. What is the King of the South? The King of the South is referenced by the young lions. They are the challengers in Ezekiel 38, are they not? They are the ones that say, "Hast thou come to take a spoil?" We have the old lion, we have Britain, we have Australia, Canada, New Zealand, India at the time. We'll have to see how that plays out. This is just taken from an enlistment poster that was in the British Empire during the past world wars. But nevertheless, you get this picture. So we have two antagonists, this to the north of Israel, this system to the south. Now you might be wondering, how does that system, how does that work? Let's take a look at the king of the north for just a minute. We have the Ottoman Turk, which occupied the northern position of the king of the north, and it was finally defeated by Allenby in 1917, and it has dried up, as the drying up of the Euphrates has referenced. But we also, and for many of us, we felt this might have been the resolution of Daniel 11. And I was certainly there. I chewed on that scenario myself. But there is going to be a latter-day occupier of that same position. And anyone that says Russia is dead, I love these phrases that you read. It says, now that the Soviet Union is dead. Because when you look at the Soviet Union today, they are the second world supplier of oil, and they are awash in petrol bucks. They just built three nuclear reactors in Iran. They have just armed Syria with sophisticated missile systems and radar guidance systems, also protecting Iran. And you have the devious Putin as their leader. So that is not a country that has gone away into oblivion. Now, if you want to take a quick look at Ezekiel 38, you'll see that we have reference to this whole horde from the first few verses on down. You have the land of Magog, Meshach, Tubal, Gog, you have All of the players are found in the ten toes are referenced by their old names in the first six verses. You have reference to 7, be thou prepared and prepare thyself and all thy company that are assembled unto thee, and be thou a guard unto them. Prepare means to set up, to erect, to direct, to turn. So this is where Christadelphians say this Daniel's image then has to stand up sometime. Right now it hasn't been able to accomplish that. But that's from this word prepare. And also it means, interestingly enough, to turn one's mind. And therefore I think you have to take that and you have to go right down and you have to apply it to turn one's mind, which accompanies its standing up in a belligerent position. Its mind is turned to think an evil thought, i.e. of conquest, to direct or aim as a weapon. Here I come, Israel. Guard is referenced custody of, that which is guarded or a keeping. So we wonder, okay, how is the Soviet a guard or a keeper of this conglomeration of nations? Well, it can be militarily, it can be influentially, if they all depend on her for oil, it can be geopolitically. We'll have to see how that plays out. Now let's take a look at the King of the South and see what we have referenced here. So on the overhead we have the young lions again, the King of the South. This is another recruiting poster that came out of Britain. And on here you see the different faces of her young lions. You have reference to the Aussies, you have India, you have the Brits, you have the U.S. as part of that. Now, this then would be the challenging, hast thou come to take a spoil element that's going to push at this. So what happened? What was the real significance of the Trade Tower bombings in 9/11 in the U.S.? Subsequently, we have the train in Spain, lastly in London. It injected the young lions into the arena, didn't it? How more quickly could you get the young lions into the Middle East than this kind of an attack scenario? That's what was accomplished there. Now, one thing we can say that's certain, and that is that the King of the South, if our interpretation is correct of the young lions, the King of the South will not be vying for headlines with Yahweh's army, will it? There's no way that headlines are going to be saying that the young lions assisted another strange force in liberating Jerusalem. It'll be totally so that thou wilt know that I am the Lord. So what has to happen to this King of the South? I can only conjecture. It could perhaps be totally annihilated, which would just allow God to claim total and unrivaled domain in the world. Or, if they are receptive, they could perhaps voluntarily stand down, back off, lay down their arms. Something just to chew on. This then, on the overhead, is showing the dynamics of the situation now. Every place you see an American flag and a British flag, you can say these are bases. These are military installations of some kind. So you can see how the young lions are in the region already. With only 170,000 troops in Iraq right now, you can see how a big invading force could easily cause the young lions to swing more south, although they're already in the south compared to the Gogian invasion up north. Now let's consider a few. I've kind of wrestled with the concept of some Jews fleeing into Moab and Jordan. Here's a verse in Isaiah 16:4. Let mine outcasts, I'll say fleeing Jews, dwell with thee, Moab. Be thou a covert to them from the face of the spoiler, for the extortioner is at the end. The spoiler ceaseth. The oppressors are consumed out of the land. So perhaps then this region in Jordan, where there might be, well, a young lion army contingency, would serve as a buffer somehow for Jews under pressure when God comes down north into Israel. I'll read Daniel 11:41. He shall enter also into the glorious land, and many shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom and Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon. Now, we know that we have a huge source of explosion and collision at Basra. Isaiah 63:1. Who is this that cometh from Edom with dyed garments from Basra? So we have a wine press scenario developing, don't we? We have a wine press scenario in Joel 3, where we're talking about vintage going into a vat, and we have a wine press scenario in Revelation 14 regarding the reaping of the vine of the earth. It's the same situation. It's just spoken of by these prophets in a little different manner. Isaiah 63:1. Who is this that cometh from Edom with dyed garments from Basra? This that is glorious in his apparel, traveling in the greatness of his strength. I who speak in righteousness, mighty to save. Why art thou red in thine apparel and thy garments, like him who treadeth in the wine fat? I have trodden the winepress alone, and the peoples there was none with me, for I will tread them in mine anger and trample them in my fury, and their blood shall be sprinkled upon my garments, and I will stain all my raiment, for the day of vengeance is in mine heart, and the year of my redeemed is come. Vengeance, you remember, is rendered to punish, or that which precedes out of justice. Indignation, you recall, comes from the Greek word orge, and we know that once things start, once the blowout starts, there's going to be no negotiating or turning back from the total and final resolution. This in Ezekiel 39, verse 11, is referenced the Valley of Hamongog, if you're still there in Ezekiel 39. It's the place where Gog will be buried, felt to be the Dead Sea Rift north of the Dead Sea in that vicinity. This battle is referenced as a great sacrifice. This word great sacrifice is from Strong's word 2077. It's the same as it's used in Numbers 7. It is rendered a peace offering. So in verse 18 to 19, we have referenced, ye shall eat fat till you be full, and drink blood till you be drunk of my sacrifice, which I have sacrificed for you. That's unfair. There'll be some tremendous war casualties. This overhead gives casualties of various familiar wars. There needs to be another one in front of the Civil War. There were 1,140,000 killed. World War I, 15 million fatalities. That's total fatalities. World War II, 55 million. Vietnam, 55,000. Holocaust, roughly 5 to 6 million. Thus then we see the charioteers going forth from Zion. Two go into the north country, where the greatest antagonists are. You can read their ancient names there. Gomer, Magog, Meshach, Rosh. We have one going south, and you have one going back and forth. The reaping of the vine of the earth was referenced. This is in Revelation 14. Each grape cluster represents figuratively an arena of hostility, but it's the same progression of the charioteers. Tie that into Isaiah 63, Joel 3:3. You have the beast system then in the north part that has to be dealt with. At Armageddon, the dragon portion, or the eastern leg of Daniel's image, is sufficiently throttled. The dragon doesn't turn up again in Revelation after this event. So you have the progression of the kingdoms of men from Assyrian, Persian, you have the Grecian with the four horns or the four divisions of Alexander the Great's fractured empire. You have the great fourth beast of Daniel's image with what? Ten horns. Ten horns on Daniel's image, Daniel chapter 2. Where are the ten horns found again? They turn up in Revelation 17. They are now on this fourth beast system. Only now we have a woman, an apostate religious system, who has managed to ride or mount up on this system again. What do we think about? Where are we with this? 10, 10, 10. The number is completion. It's secular, organizational completion. 10 toes on Daniel's image, 10 toes on the fourth beast in Daniel 7, 10 kings in Revelation 17 who give their power to the beast, we're told, for 1 hour. This then is the papal system, who has found another suitor. She found a suitor, didn't she, upon the fall of Rome in 427. We have Justinian ruling from Constantinople, and Phocas giving the Roman pontiff all power. This then came together in the Holy Roman Empire under the organization of Charlemagne, who organized the 10 Germanic barbarian countries to form his empire. And we have consequently in Revelation 13 the Lamb with the two horns, a political entity, Charlemagne, a religious entity, the papacy. It's no coincidence then that when the Treaty of Rome was signed, it was at this same place in Italy last November when things were signed again. It was in the same hall under the towering figure of Julius Caesar. You can't take Rome or iron out of the clay toes, can you? This is the EU. These have one mind and shall give their power and strength unto the beast. That situation is the exact same place it was on. It was on the hill there. The hall, this hall, was the Palazzo Senatorio that was the seat of government for 2,500 years during the most influential days of Rome. The proceedings took place under the huge statue of Julius Caesar and the outstretched hand of another huge statue at the other end of the hall, Pope Innocent. You got them right there together. So, you have these ancient coins of Europe, Europa, a woman riding a bull. History documents this. You have this mosaic found in Kent, England, of a Roman bath, a woman riding a bull. Now, we come back around. The contents of the looming great mountain in Zechariah 4:7 now becomes like the chaff of the summer threshing floor in Daniel 2. Revelation 16:20, and the mountains were not found. It doesn't mean all the mountains are ground down. It references the mountains of human opposition and belligerence. That's what's referenced. So we come back around, and we are now at the first vision again. The four charioteers have done their work. War is over. It's time now to savor the Feast of Tabernacles amongst the myrtles, an ornamental, figurative, fragrant tree, resurrection, the building of Ezekiel's temple, and its services to begin. Dr. Thomas estimates this time frame may take 40 years. Hence, we come to the end of our class. John 14, verse 27, Jesus said, "Peace I leave with you, my peace, not as the world giveth, give I unto you." We have considered the peace process, have we not? Peace means to join, to set at one again. At the end of the 1,000 years, and as we come into the 8th day, total peace will be nothing less than covenant peace. Thanks.